This is session number 14, Beyond the 1978 Revelation, Two Perspectives. And my name is Newell Bringhurst. I'm a teacher of history and government at a College of the Sequoias in Visalia, California. And it's nice to see as many people here in this session. I think we're going to have a very lively and a very stimulating session. But let me just give a little bit in terms of background, how this session came to be, and just a little bit about our two presenters today. And then I will let each of the two presenters go, and then I will make a few comments. And I want to leave sufficient time for you to ask questions. Hopefully you'll have questions and be prompted to make inquiries to me. That's always the best part of these Sunstone sessions, is to get your reaction and your input to what's presented here today. But let me just go ahead. I was prompted to organize this session by the approaching 25th anniversary of the 1978 Black Revelation, which comes in June 2003. This caused me to reflect anew on the ever-changing status of black, of people of African descent within the church. I must confess that in recent years, however, my involvement with the Mormon black issue has been limited, with my research primarily focused in other areas. But I continue to follow with great interest the important research being done by other scholars, most notably Armin Moss, one of our two panelists today, who will give our first presentation. To Sunstone regulars, Armin Moss hardly needs introducing, but I feel compelled to note a few facts about his background and scholarship. Armin grew up and attended schools here in California, receiving his PhD from the University of California, Berkeley. He actually began to investigate the issue of blacks in the church in the early 1960s, and has continued research on this topic right down to the present, a span of some 40 years, covering more than half of his lifetime. I thought about that because I serve in a similar position. More than half of our lifetimes have been devoted to looking at this issue. I guess that shows what a compelling issue it is, and it continues to be. Armin's first article on this topic was a path-breaking article that appeared in 1966. I think it's the Pacific Sociological Review. Is that correct? And he has written a number of subsequent articles on this and other topics that appeared in various publications, including Dialogue, Sunstone, and the Journal of Mormon History. Armin is the co-editor, along with Lester Bush, of Neither White Nor Black, Mormon Scholars Confront the Race Issue in a Universal Church. And that was published in 1984. And he's also the author of The Angel and the Beehive, The Mormon Struggle with Assimilation, which is really a seminal study. I think it's one of the most important studies dealing with contemporary Mormonism that is out there. That was published in 1994. But the culmination of Armin's lifetime of research on the Mormon black issue is going to be his eagerly awaited, long in preparation, book, All Abraham's Children, Changing Mormon Conceptions of Race and Lineage. Is that the correct title? Is that the final title? It's slated for publication, is it later this year or 2003? When University of Illinois Press gets it out in print, and it is going to be it's really something. I've had a chance to read some of the chapters in there, and it's really a fine piece of work. His presentation today is entitled Casting Off the Curse of Cain. Now, our second presenter, Darren T. Smith, approaches the topic of African Americans within the church from a somewhat different perspective and background. Darren was born in Nashville, Tennessee in 1965, at the approximate time that Armin Moss was preparing his first article on the Mormon black issue. So in a way, we're trying to pass the torch a little bit here today. The torch will be passed. When Darren was 6 months old, his family moved here to California, where he spent his childhood years in the predominantly black area of South Central Los Angeles. In 1976, Darren's mother moved the family back to Nashville, Tennessee, where Darren's grandmother lived. It was in Nashville that Darren first came in contact with the LDS Church through an African-American friend who had earlier joined the church. Darren was baptized at age 15. After graduation from high school, he attended Ricks College, now BYU, Idaho, where he played football. He's actually one of the star football players on the team. If you look for BYU, Idaho's football team today, alas, it doesn't exist anymore. They've dropped athletics completely. Darren then attended the University of Utah, where he received 2 degrees. The first was a B.S. in health, a Bachelor of Science in health, and the second a physician's assistant degree through that institution's School of Medicine. Darren also holds a master's degree in education from Brigham Young University and is currently a doctoral candidate at the University of Utah in the area of organizational communication. Now, I should mention, I plugged Armin's book. I'm going to plug Darren's book. I think it's only fair. Darren has vividly related his life story in his autobiography. I have a copy of it right here, entitled What Matters Most? The Story of Human Potential, which I understand he's got some copies available. He'll sell them to you at the back of his car. But... it's really a compelling autobiographical account. His presentation today sort of builds on that. It is entitled Unpacking Whiteness in Zion: Some Personal Reflections and General Observations. I should note that I'm going to really enforce the time limit. Otherwise, the longer they talk, the less favorable my comments and response will be in inversely proportional, because I'll mention what a challenge it was in terms of length. Armin submitted to me a 54-page paper with 13 pages of footnotes. Darren's paper was quite long too. It was 19 pages with 2 or 3 pages of footnotes. And so, if they actually read the length of their papers, we would probably be here until 4 or 5. We're not going to do that. Okay, so first Armin and then Darren.
Thank you for that generous introduction. I'm mostly going to talk without notes, with notes, and not read the paper. You'll be relieved to know, but I do want to read like the first very few pages just to set the stage. The anguished history of the black membership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is by now a well-told story, which does not need recounting here. And I cite a number of books where that story is told. The story is rooted in 3 episodes in particular, each crucial in its own way, and each itself a culmination of a unique process. The first was Brigham Young's 1852 Declaration of Church Policy denying blacks access to the lay priesthood. That was the first unique event that was the first episode culminating a process. Second was a partial reconsideration, but then confirmation and institutionalization of that policy in the 1880s. And finally, the 1978 revelation which overturned the policy and extended the priesthood to, quote, all worthy male members without regard to race or color. As the 21st century arrived, a fourth process was underway with uncertain prospects. This process might be called the struggle to cast off the curse of Cain, not only from the black peoples of the earth, on whom it has traditionally been imposed, but indeed from the LDS Church itself, which continues to bear the burden of its own racist heritage. This essay deals mainly with that fourth struggle, as it has unfolded since 1978. It is a struggle occurring on two levels. At the operational level, there is a conscientious outreach by the church toward black people everywhere. Meanwhile, at the ideological level, there is a less clear strategy for coping with the doctrinal residue of the discarded racial policy, especially in North America. The revelation and policy change of 1978 in a single administrative act removed all formal restrictions on full participation in LDS church life by people of black African ancestry. What has been much slower to change, however, has been almost two centuries of accumulated racial and religious folklore among white American Mormons. This folklore has been constructed over many years to defend and explain, that is, explain in quotation marks, expend and explain to Mormons and others the erstwhile policy of withholding the priesthood from a divinely disfavored lineage. Even though this policy itself has been overturned, the folklore for rationalizing it has lingered on at the grassroots, despite its manifest irrelevance to contemporary church life. In particular, the notion that blacks were descendants of Cain now seems ironically to have taken on a life of its own as now a post hoc explanation for the historical origin of the obsolete priesthood restriction. So now it's being used to explain when somebody asks, well, why did you ever have that policy? Why, you go back and explain, you know, use the same explanation for what was used to justify it when it was the policy. The general authorities of the church themselves no longer offer such explanations, but these have continued to be circulated in conversation and in print through authoritative books written by earlier leaders and commentators. One of the great popular myths in traditional Mormonism, quite apart from racial questions, is that people can find in this religion all the answers they need, answers in quotation marks. A consequence of this myth is a manifest discomfort at the grassroots with quandaries that seem to have no ready explanations. Producing those explanations has always been a growth industry among the Mormon folk, as attested by a vast scholarly literature on folklore. In the particular case at hand, the explanation has still been circulating that blacks are, as they always were, descendants of Cain, but that lately God has relented and removed the curse from that lineage so that it could finally participate in the priesthood. Since such ideas were not officially and explicitly repudiated in 1978, along with the priesthood restriction itself, they have continued to be offered by well-meaning local members, leaders, and teachers, and missionaries whenever questions arise about why the restriction on priesthood had ever existed in the church in the first place. In the apparent hope that with time all such vestiges of racism would eventually die a natural death, most church leaders have assumed a posture of benign neglect toward them, a matter which we will consider more fully at the end. Meanwhile, the church has looked for ways of constructively engaging black people as current and future church members. In this endeavor, the church seems to have had less success in North America than elsewhere. It is difficult to ascertain just how successful the Mormon missionary program has been among black Mormons since 1978. Excuse me, among black Americans since 1978. Ordinary church records do not keep track of race or ethnicity, so we are dependent on unsystematic samples and anecdotal evidence. Certainly the church publications have given more exposure than ever before to stories of black conversion, spiritual and social growth of new black members, and their inspiring encounters with divine influences. A sheer count of such stories would be misleading, however, since a large proportion of them deal with cases outside the United States. If you go to an index of church periodicals, you'll see a mushrooming of stuff on blacks Negroes, African Americans, or whatever the term is used at a given stage in history. It keeps changing. And you'll see that mushrooming starts in the 70s and, you know, increases as you go along. So the church periodicals are covering the people of black African ancestry more than they ever did. You know, you go back before about 1960 and you can hardly find any references in church news or the improvement era as it was then, or any church periodicals. So a sheer count of such stories would be misleading, however, since a large proportion of them deal with cases outside the United States, mainly Africa. Newell Bringhurst made a study of how the church news presented the image of blacks as prime instruments of church growth and expansion during the first decade after 1978. He concluded that in strictly geographic terms, the church had made great strides in large sections and populations of the world traditionally neglected by LDS missionaries, such as Africa. In numerical terms, however, Bringhurst found church news claims of rapid black growth to be a little exaggerated in some of the countries. In the United States itself, growth was actually very slow, if you include in growth not just baptism records, but retention after a year. So what we have then going on simultaneously are two levels. I mentioned an operational level where I think there is a genuine and sincere effort through the institutional church at different kinds of outreach, both to black members and to potential members or non-members. The other one is what to do about sort of cleaning up the residue inside the church, and that hasn't progressed very fast. But let me give you an idea of some of the things that have happened in the first category of operational efforts at outreach. I get my data on this subject from both from the ordinary news reports in the American press, I mean from New York Times all the way west, as well as from the church news itself and even the BYU paper, plus at least three different newsletters have on and off been published by the black LDS community in Utah. These are called respectively Genesis, which is published by the Genesis Group, a 30-plus year organization that others perhaps will talk about. But that newsletter has been published very spasmodically, and it's hard to find a complete file of them. So I have only a few copies. But two others were published for roughly 7 to 10 years each, with some overlapping. One was called Ebony Rose, was published on the initiative mainly of Marva Collins when she lived in the West. And the other was published, is called Uplift, published by the LDS Cultural Awareness Association, mainly an organization of Black Latter-day Saints. When you look at back, and I've got back issues of those, when you go through all of these, you get an understanding of not only what the church thinks it's doing, but what the black folks who produced those publications thought about it. And so you see that there's just been a great deal going on, and I'm not going to tell you much about any one of them, but some of you might remember in 1988 there was a big anniversary celebration based at BYU for the 10th anniversary of the change in priesthood policy. And that, you know, imported a couple of high-profile black speakers and was under the direct MC efforts of Dahlin Oaks, and it was quite a bash. Since then, the church, and even before that, the church has been fairly conscientious about doing whatever it could to support activities during Black History Week, which is February every year, and Martin Luther King holiday in January. Some of those celebrations have been on the initiative of Black Latter-day Saints. I'm talking about Utah mainly, but increasingly it's starting in Southern California too. But the church has either funded those activities or given other forms of direct help and encouragement. In January 1991, there was a big interfaith conference on Martin Luther King and what he stood for that was hosted by the enormous Interstate Center up in Oakland, the church's Interstate Center. People came from all over the place. And then afterward, the Relief Society sisters had everybody go next door to the chapel for serving refreshments. I think it was green jello, but I'm not sure. A year later, in January of 92, another big interfaith event focusing on the black experience and made up mostly of black people was put on in the Van Nuys Stake Center. These are, you know, events where the local church leaders are offering these facilities and giving support. One of the things that I discovered only recently was a rather amazing outpouring of local LDS origin, outpouring of effort, right after the 1992 LA riots, when two stakes, Palos Verdes and LA stakes, began a process of carrying van loads full of food and clothing into the South Central area where the riots had been centered, and worked closely with Reverend Murray, Cecil Murray. I think he's called Chip to his friends. I haven't personally met him. He's head of the AME, African Methodist Episcopal Church there, which is a major church in that area. There's a whole long story about it, which I have in my files, and even though I have to say that I got, I have to, for truth in advertising, say that I got my information from a long press release and report to general authorities that was put out by the Los Angeles LDS Public Affairs Office. Those of you who know Keith Atkinson, who runs that office, know that he's a reliable person. And as I read that, I was amazed at how much initiative was taken by the local LDS folks to repeatedly bring in the necessary food, clothing. And it was only the beginning, because there have been periodic forays of that kind regularly thereafter. And a permanent relationship was established between the leadership of those stakes and Reverend Murray and his church. That still goes on to this day. An indication of that regular relationship is that in December, this last December, the Reverend Murray's church, for the first time I think in its history, gave out something called a Lovejoy Award in honor of a member of their congregation named Lovejoy who had passed on, but was being honored for his acts of Christian kindness and charity. Well, Reverend Murray, after 10 years of this, an association with Mormons, which started out, by the way, as you might imagine, with a lot of skepticism on his part, especially about how long it was going to last. But after 10 years, he decided that that Reverend Murray decided, and his congregation, that they wanted to give that first Lovejoy Award to in a way that would honor this connection with the Latter-day Saints. And they wanted to give it to President Hinckley. And I think it did actually go to President Hinckley, but he was not able personally to come and get it. But he sent Elder Hales of the 12 to come and receive that award. And that happened only last December. There are a couple of other things that I could mention that I think you know as much about as I do. You know, in February, these are all Black History Months, remember? In February of last year, 2001, there was the Freedmen's Bank cache of genealogical stuff that got a lot of publicity. And then in this year, February 2002, there was a big gathering on the temple grounds in the Washington, D.C. temple, at which the head of the African American History and Culture Museum was invited to bring some of his collection and put in the visitor center as a part of their exhibit, on the temple grounds for, and I think it's still there, I'm not sure how long that lasts, but that was accompanied by meetings there and accompanied by lectures given by people from the Genesis group like Darius Gray. Anyway, it's been ongoing. Let's see, how are we doing here on time? I'm not sure where I am.
You've gone about 20 minutes so far.
Have I gone 20 minutes? Well,
I'm on track.
How much time do I get? Five more or what?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's an incident that I could tell you more about, but you really should read it in the Ostling and Ostling book. Do you know that book, Mormon America? Look it up on pages 103 to 105, where you will read in there about an effort made at the level of Marlon Jensen of the 70 to launch a campaign to get a public repudiation of the Cain and Ham and pre-existence explanations, quote-unquote. The effort was aborted when a local black brother got impatient with the progress and went to the press with a story that this was going on. And so then President Hinckley was asked about it and, you know, had to publicly say, I don't know anything about this. You know, we're not contemplating anything like that. So that was too bad, but I don't think that effort is over. Now, Brother Jensen has a personal thing about this. He really believes that this has to be done. Unfortunately, he's now in Europe in an area presidency. I don't think the two are related. But when he gets back, I think he will pick it up again. You have to say that he got a fair amount of egg on his face in this process when you know the rug was pulled out from under him by a press statement from the First Presidency over this, because it just hadn't gotten to their level yet. These things work their way up in bureaucracies. Let me make a couple of other observations, then I'll quit. Another thing, one thing that if you look at survey data, now there's some good surveys out that compare, where sociologists can sort out people of Latter-day Saint origins or people who claim Latter-day Saint membership and compare them with a random sample of Americans generally. And when you make those comparisons, which you can do now by decade, and I've done it, and there's some tables in my paper about it. What you see is that when you ask in these standard questionnaires, national questionnaires, surveys, actually they're interviews done by the, Gallup-type interviews done by the General Social Science Service, GSS, under National Opinion Research Corporation. When you do those surveys, you find that progressively since the policy change on the priesthood, Mormons compared to non-Mormons have become increasingly liberal and open on all civil rights questions. Mormons are now, believe it or not, on the liberal side of the spectrum compared to a random sample of average Americans. So, you know, we're and this is true on such questions as open housing, integrated education, welfare services, whether or not you'd be comfortable having a person of a different race come to dinner is one of the questions that was asked. On all those kinds of questions, Mormons now look pretty good. You know, to me that's good news, but the other side of the story is how long was that traditional church restriction and the folklore that went with it holding back that exact kind of change? One wonders if Mormons might not have been ahead of the rest of the country in the 60s instead of behind the rest of the country if this change had come sooner. But once the change came, I think the church as a whole has been catching up and even going ahead, if you regard going ahead as in including the opening up toward and favorability toward civil rights in the secular civil realm. But what we have then is a whole bunch of unfinished business. Despite all of these good things that are going on at the institutional level and at the secular civil level in black-white relations, we're still encountering in the church, and black people as well as white people, when they ask their local bishop or they ask a missionary or they ask somebody else in supposed authority, their home teacher, how come the church ever had this policy? Well, I think one good thing that's happened is I think the single most frequent answer that they are likely to get is, well, you know, that's always been a mystery to me too. I don't really know. And that would be okay if that's what people would say. But the second most frequent response is, well, you know, you folks are descendants of Cain. and the Lord finally decided that it was okay for the descendants of Cain to have the priesthood. You know, aren't you pleased? It's not in that tone, but, you know, that's how it comes across. So we have a long way to go, and there's a lot more to say about it, but you'll be relieved to know I'm not going to say it for now. Thank you.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and start my paper. Before I begin, I just wanted to comment that it's so ironic that I'm actually up here with these two men. I've read their works several years ago, probably 10 or 15 years ago, and it's just kind of a strange twist of fate that I'm actually here with them presenting a paper. My paper is actually entitled Unpacking Whiteness and Zion, Some Personal Reflections and General Observations. I'm going to skip around a lot, so I'll explain. Hopefully we'll have a chance to discuss this afterwards, but I'll just kind of skip around a little bit. As an African-American member of the church, I was disturbed both personally and spiritually by an unpleasant incident that occurred in my ward. This incident involved Joy Smith, a teacher of the Relief Society's a women's organization in the church. According to Ms. Smith, while trying to engage her class on the topic of following the prophets, she posed the following hypothetical question: should all the teachings of Mormon prophets be obeyed, even those with blatantly racist ideas, strongly condemning interracial marriage? Before any meaningful discussion could take place, her Relief Society president, who was present, abruptly interrupted Ms. Smith. She was informed that her line of discussion was out of bounds because, in the end, she was unduly criticizing church leaders, who are considered the Lord's anointed. Despite the Relief Society president's persistent effort to steer her away from problematizing church leaders, Joy Smith refused to be silenced. Within 3 weeks, she was released from her calling for, according to the society's president, not following the prescribed lesson format. After prodding the president about the nature of the dismissal, the president said, "Church is not the place for discussing these matters." In the end, although herself white, Joy Smith had committed the unacceptable, if not unpardonable. She dared to interrogate whiteness and thereby created an unsafe space for the white members of her ward's Relief Society, beginning with the president. Consequently, she had to be made a martyr. Joyce Smith's action provides insight into what Dreema Moon calls silencing dissenters. Moon explains, by silencing dissenters, the tyranny of bourgeois decorum creates safe, in quotation marks, spaces in which dominant ideologies go unchallenged, harmony is preserved, and the party line is maintained. Within these safe spaces, dissenting voices are often punished by exclusion and ostracism by the white community. In the end, I was affected directly and personally by the whole incident, not simply because the Disciplined Relief Society sister was a member of my ward, but specifically because she was my wife, Joy Smith, white and the mother of my two beautiful biracial children, conceived in love and an interracial marriage. Our dilemma is thus most visible. Not only was my wife disciplined by her Relief Society president, but her Relief Society president felt compelled to ask a higher authority to reteach the same lesson in an effort to fix or make right what was presumably disrupted, thus maintaining a possessive investment in whiteness. Spiritually, I was deeply concerned about this incident because, as a socially conscious African-American Latter-day Saint, I strongly believe that the church should serve as a forum to discuss approved matters of doctrine, but also related issues of controversy that impact on personal belief. The church cannot expect its members to be oblivious to or completely ignorant, or completely ignore crucial issues of race, gender, or sexuality, particularly given the central role these issues have played in the history of Mormonism from its earliest days. Ideally, such ideas should be subject to intelligent and logical exploration and understanding. Within Mormon culture, the silencing of those individuals who challenge white supremacist thinking is a form of race evasiveness. Dream of Moon labels such individuals who challenge white supremacist thinking truth tellers. My courageous, sometimes outspoken wife is one such truth teller who suffered the repercussions of violating white silence. In the wake of my wife's ordeal, I was reminded of a conversation I had with a high church official who gave me additional insights into the dynamics of race evasiveness in the church. This individual was interested in why a college-level course on race was needed, further commenting that such classes would be divisive, dividing us rather than uniting us. This semantic evasion, as Christina Schlitter notes, personifies making it rather than ourselves the subject of sentences. This allows us to say, for example, racism causes poor education in inner city schools. Who is responsible for the quality of education in the inner city schools? The sentence does not suggest that anyone holds responsibility. In my conversation with the church official, he removed himself from any responsibility of addressing the church's lack of racial awareness. He was unwilling to support institutional change regarding the role of race in the academy, blaming the course as the problem rather than the institution. Inevitably, his unwillingness and that of other church officials to engage in race discussions endorses and perpetuates the American myth that people of color are now a meaningful part of and are doing well in a larger racist society. If whites can pretend that blacks are upwardly mobile and economically solvent, then discussing oppression becomes fruitless and the perpetuation of racism is assured. What is needed instead is open and frank discussion, or a strategy known as race talk, which is an opportunity for important discussions, conversations, and dialogue that have every possibility to demystify race and raise consciousness that white racism is not the aberration that most whites believe, but a fact of life central to the American experience. American history is replete with how black slaves foraged and cultivated the land, cleared the forest, and offered African medicinal remedies for their oppressors, yet their contributions go largely unnoticed. According to James D. Anderson, the discussion of race is generally limited to the Civil War, Reconstruction, the defense of slavery, and the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s and 1970s, all areas where race is impossible to ignore. Discussing racial beliefs in U.S. society is often a taboo that derails any efforts to deal head-on with our past or present racism. Alas, the church mirrors this national avoidance of race talk. This, in turn, has the potential of adversely affecting missionary work, growth, and African-American member retention. Evading race talk is problematic, particularly since most members of the church, for example, are under the illusion that once African-Americans convert to the church, they are satisfied, content, and complacent, and thus all is well in Zion. This illusion is a way for whites to suppress the differential experiences that impact the lives of race people. To clarify and further problematize what the central issues are, I will focus on two tenets of whiteness theory. I'm going to skip to this notion of whiteness theory. Whiteness theory is an analytical tool that specifically names and displaces whiteness as a monolithic power structure and informs us that white privilege is a system working to sustain the normalization of whiteness at the center of knowledge production. Whiteness theory affirms that white is not a biological distinction, but rather a social construction that gives benefits to whites and to those passing as white. For some Americans, according to Audrey Thompson, this comes in the form of good schools, neighborhoods that provide better material advantages, safety from toxic material or greater access to medical resources is among some of the material benefits of whiteness, some of the material benefits of whiteness. Symbolic forms of privilege would include white conceptions of beauty and intelligence that are not only tied to whiteness, but that implicitly exclude people of color. Whiteness is a definitional term, a cultural and social construction, a system of structural privilege that offers white advantages in ways that people of color do not experience. But whiteness is not only limited to bodies and skin color, but rather ideas, knowledge production, values and beliefs that are held as the norm. The way America comes to appreciate history, art, literature, good health, and popular culture, for example, are a few advantages of the normalization of whiteness. People of color are rarely seen in movies unless they're portrayed as the villain or sidekick of the mythic white hero. Books, greeting cards, children's toys, billboards, and popular magazines are overwhelmingly situated in whiteness. Is this an accident? Whiteness, as a protected and often guarded entitlement, goes unnoticed and unchecked because of its suppressed or ignored nature. Therefore, white people are either unable or unwilling to recognize how their elite position enables them in so many ways. Maintaining silence is just one way of preserving these privileges. Rather than engaging in any dialogue that promotes growth, whiteness must avoid conflict at any cost in order to retain white hegemony. When white people say, for example, "Let's not be at odds with each other," or contentious, and so without opposition, whiteness always wins. Unwittingly, the church then becomes a site where whiteness operates in opposition to people of color. Whiteness as a discursive concept looks at how language and symbolism are situated in whiteness as the natural state of being. Such ingrained cultural perceptions have historically and contemporarily been framed in dualisms. For example, good always wins over evil, which is constructed in Mormon contexts, with good being equal to white and delightsome, and evil equating to dark and loathsome. Former church president Spencer W. Kimball, who is credited with lifting the priesthood ban on blacks, illustrates how language powerfully inscribes color consciousness. The following excerpt is from a General Conference report, October 1960, regarding Native Americans, who Mormons refer to as Lamanites. In a striking contrast, in the progress of the Indian people today, the days of the Lamanite is nigh. For years they have been growing delightsome, and they are now becoming white and delightsome. And they are promised, in this picture of the 20 Lamanite missionaries, 15 or 20 were as light as Anglos. 5 were darker, but equally delightsome. The children in the home placement program in Utah are often lighter than their brothers and sisters in the Hogan on the reservation. These notions are all functions of whiteness that privilege ways of knowing that are invisible to most whites and only become apparent, hypervisible, when threatened. As the unmarked category, whiteness never has to speak its name or say anything racial. Yet, according to Ruth Frankenberg, whiteness retains its space of neutrality, allowing whites to view the other as deviant, thus reinscribing established patterns of white supremacy through fear and loathing of the other that is marked by inferiority. The history of tension between whites and the other is frequently interpreted by whites as a people of color problem. This explanation permits whites to distance themselves from the other, blaming blacks, Native Americans, Asian Americans, and Latinos for America's social problems. The social construction of whiteness permits ways to discuss, without naming anyone a racist, and explore how white people benefit from the reproduction of systemic racism. 2 more points. A good example of whiteness as a naturalized condition in the LDS Church is how white maleness and leadership are intertwined. The priesthood is an all-male institution that gives men authority to speak in the name in the Lord's name, administer all church duties, receive revelations, and serve in all church and serve in all church and gospel ordinances. The church revolves around and is guided by the lay priesthood and would drift into oblivion without it. Church members rely on the priesthood to guide and direct institutional policy and the spiritual direction of the church. Historically, however, the institutionalization of white male priesthood dominance has been the norm. Currently, the general leadership of the church continues its overrepresentation of whiteness. This is problematic. How can the general leadership of the church, the brethren, all white males, know all ways of knowing for each racial group, let alone the discourses of other countries and cultures. On the one hand, the interpretive lens that is used by the brethren has a Eurocentric tint. Yet, on the other hand, many members of the church would contend that race is irrelevant, and race does not matter because the gospel and the priesthood are able to circumvent social barriers, such as race and ethnicity. In contrast, Shearing and Young convincingly argue that these influential people and their world-making or reality-making activities or practice, however, are not separate from the social histories within which they live. All knowledge is relative to the context in which it is generated, and thus, when academics and public opinion leaders construct knowledge, they're influenced by the ideas, assumptions, and norms of the culture and sub-societies in which they are socialized. In other words, experiences. The romantic notion of colorblindness, as Andrew Hacker notes in Two Nations, has yet to change the landscape of power and influence. People of color remain at the margins with little influence in almost all organizations, including churches. Even those minorities who are accepted are expected to be, quote, white identified. Another key element of institutional colorblindness is the common assumption that all Americans share a similar social experience. The language of colorblindness hides and makes it harder to detect repressive and racist ways. The nature of colorblindness deflects attention away from those who are most oppressed in U.S. society by allowing whites to hold on to their racial privilege as the normal state of Americanism. Whites can then absolve themselves and feel good that they're not prejudiced, further distancing themselves from the other. The discourse of colorblindness, according to Ruth Frankenberg, is good only insofar as their people of color, coloredness can be bracketed and ignored, and this bracketing is contingent on the ability or the decision, in fact, the virtue of a non-colored or white self. Colorblindness, despite its best intentions of its adherence, in this sense, preserves the power structure inherent in essentialist racism. Let me give you an example of how this operates institutionally. I think this might hit home a little bit more. I was reminded of another example of spiritual colorblindness through the experience of Sister Tahoe, a Maori member of my ward. Sister Tahoe expressed to me her concerns regarding her 15-year-old son, Taki Jr., who faithfully attends all church meetings and activities. Sister Tahoe explained that he was frustrated because it appeared to him that every other young man in his quorum gets an opportunity to serve as president except him. When I brought Sister Tahoe and Taki's concerns before the bishop, he became quite defensive, suggesting that the time was not right for Taki to become quorum president. The bishop never once considered the Tahoe family or acknowledged Taki's talents and potential contribution. As far as he was concerned, the Lord decides these matters. The bishop's reluctance to acknowledge his own biases while shifting the discussion to the Lord prevents unfairness to enter the discussion, resulting in, not surprisingly, a race avoidance tactic. The bishop insisted that he was not prejudiced. After all, he had served the church in Africa and in the Polynesian islands. The bishop's retort demonstrates that colorblindness is not necessarily overt racism. We're not talking about Klan. We're not talking about skinheads. We're talking about knowledge production, but rather a neutral discourse that avoids the prevalence and practice of discrimination while upholding the institutional whiteness of the church. When race is addressed in situations such as my own experience and that of Taki Jr.'s, whites are uncomfortable. The avoidance of race talk is similar to colorblindness, but the two are distinct in that evasion is selective engagement of difference rather than no engagement at all. And let me give you a conclusion of this. This is a lot of stuff in here, so I want to skip to the more important aspects. I want to talk about how this has impacted Genesis, the Genesis group in Salt Lake City. I happen to belong to that particular organization, and give some impressions of Genesis. The need for reform in the church is evident when considering how the institution enculturates whiteness by maintaining as a result of these practices, a sanitized atmosphere envelops procedures and methods repressing discussions about the life experiences of its race members. So we don't talk about the experiences of race people. We just ignore them. We assume that those experiences are universal, right? And universality, at least in this context, is always synonymous with whiteness. The one-size-fits-all policy is problematic. not only globally among ethnic memberships of the church, but more specifically for African Americans. In this regard, the church could learn an important lesson from institutions such as the Black Church. Most African Americans have had some roots in the Black Church, which offers both a safe and unsafe space. The safe space is supplied by the Black Church through its rich spiritual tradition, representative of the life and mission of Jesus Christ. For example, the Black Church not only offers a spiritual foundation, but according to Tatum, a role in both community development and psychological and social support. On the one hand, during the Black freedom struggle of the Civil Rights era, for example, African Americans would draw parallels between biblical figures such as Moses and the plight of the children of Israel from Egyptian bondage. On the other hand, the unsafe nature of the Black Church provided opportunity for strategizing, resistance to white hegemony, and the social injustices that for the Black community were significant in strengthening Black resolve against the terror of whiteness. African Americans have a long tradition of using the Black Church as a site to discuss race talk, in contrast to the LDS Church that has yet to embrace the importance of this Black religious tradition. Consequently, the church ends up affirming the normalization of whiteness. Genesis, a branch of the Church of Jesus Christ located in Salt Lake City, can hardly be called a Black church, yet it does fulfill an important role for Black members. Genesis was formed in October 1971 by the LDS Church to help Black members in Utah feel included within white Mormon culture, while taking pride in their own cultural ethnic background. The group meets monthly on a Sunday evening for fellowship, music, and sharing their feelings about God. Genesis affords Blacks with a pseudo-safe space outside the traditional boundaries of the church, of the LDS ward. Regrettably, Genesis remains secure in that it does not deviate from the established whiteness of the LDS church in general, with one major exception. It does not have a sacrament service. This unsafe aspect of Genesis is problematic in that Black members seem to ignore the past and present racism within the church. Genesis could do more than just provide a powerful social political force within the church. It could strengthen the voices of color by forefronting the diverse experiences of its members. It could coalition build with the general church leadership to implement changes in the power structure. Importantly, Genesis could elicit an apology from the church regarding its history and discrimination of peoples of African descent and advocate racist teachings which continue at present. Sadly, it does none of these. To his credit, Darius Gray, the current president of Genesis, has problematized that Genesis must be more than food, fun, and festivities that is often constructed as a multicultural project. In November 2000, Gray commented, "June of 1978 changed so many things and left unchanged too many things." I think this kind of speaks to Armin's claim at the end of his presentation that there's more work to be done in this effort. "We are far more tolerant of African Americans in our presence, and while we are, the lack of comfort with ethnicity and racial diversity affects the reception that Blacks receive." Close quote. Ultimately, however, the responsibility for transforming the church does not rest on Genesis' shoulders. White members must share the burden for change and interrogate how whiteness creates barriers for progress. This issue becomes more salient as white families in the church, particularly in Utah, are increasingly adopting African-American children. Still, Genesis is a site for demonstrating white tolerance and racial progress of the church in hopes of appeasing racial concerns. Blacks, too, become mystified by what they perceive to be improvement, a common assumption being that the church is growing in Africa and Genesis is thriving. It is not unusual to hear socially conscious Black and white, in quotation marks, socially conscious Black and white members say that change is coming, but slowly. Be patient, suggesting that as the leadership changes, so will the discourse. But institutionally, the church remains the same, status quo. The discourse has not changed and will not change as long as members of the church hold on to the belief that change will come in the Lord's own time. This kind of uncritical analysis that white folk in the church can transcend race with the Lord's guidance is unlikely, especially when there's an investment in white supremacy that speaks through folks, whether or not they perceive themselves as racist. And oftentimes, the distinction between the two are very, very fine. On the one hand, racism is often constructed as in terms of individual acts of aggression. Me burning a cross on someone's yard, me calling someone a nig, and so on and so forth. On the other hand, the racist project is often ignored in institutional processes like what we're talking about here. Okay, where am I at here? I lost my place. Oh, okay, yeah. Just about done here. And then in conclusion, I want to say this. The church, like many American institutions, finds itself in a dilemma. For 400 years, America was founded on white supremacist ideologies and principles. As history has taught us, it will take more than civil rights legislation to reverse the polarized psychological effects of racialized thinking. Whether whites admit it or not, many harbor racist thoughts that get inscribed into organizational cultures. The church is one site where this fact is reality. In summary, by using whiteness throughout the chapter or throughout this particular essay, I've addressed two concerns that I'm convinced prevent the church from being the kind of institution that it professes to be: color blindness and race evasiveness. It is my conviction that both remain stumbling blocks and inhibit racial progress in the church. If there is to be progress, then church members and leaders must question whiteness and acknowledge that race matters. Thank you.
I'm sure you're as moved as I am, but the two fantastic presentations. I should mention, you know, I plugged Armin's book and I plugged Darren's book. I'm going to plug a book that that Darren and I are actually co-editing. We're in the process. The two presentations that you heard here today are going to be included in a volume that is under publication consideration by the University of Illinois Press, and there are several other authors. There are going to be a total of 8 essays that all deal with the issues of race within the church beyond the 1978 revelation, things that have happened since, because nobody's really addressed that, and these two papers have done a fantastic job doing that. These two papers will form the core of that volume. There's also going to be essays in there by Jesse Embry, who's also done a lot of work in this area, Darius Gray, who is also the co-author of that ongoing trilogy. He's going to have an essay that he's writing in conjunction with Ron Coleman, Ken Driggs, and Alma Allred, an independent scholar. And I mentioned Cardell Jacobson, who is going to be doing it from a sociological point of view, and then I'm contributing an essay. So we're hoping to get that out early next year. So I just thought I'd mention that these are slated to move beyond. But let me just go ahead and make a few comments, and I want to leave some time for questions and comments from you. We've got about a half hour, and I'm going to try to, hopefully this won't take any longer than 5 to 10 minutes. I should point out that I have to confess that the task of sitting down to organize my comments on these two papers ended up being a much more daunting and challenging task than I'd originally anticipated. This, despite the fact that I've done a fair amount of research and writing of my own on this issue, on the issue of Mormon-black relations. And as I said, part of this was complicated by the fact that the papers themselves were originally longer. I want to really praise and compliment not only the quality of the presentation, but the fact that they trimmed it down within the time frames and really got at the essence of what was contained in the papers themselves. But the thing that was so challenging for me was the multifaceted theoretical approach taken by Moss and Smith in their respective papers. This indicates to me how far the scholarship and analysis of this topic has evolved, becoming much more sophisticated and much more theoretical since the publication of my own relatively unadorned historical account, Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, which I completed which was published over 20 years ago. Armin Moss provides a somewhat mixed assessment in the way the church has dealt with various issues involving people of African descent since 1978. On the positive side, he notes that at the operational level, there has been a continuous outreach by the church toward black people everywhere. The church, in its public relations outreach, has, in addition to its usual missionary programs, has tried to cultivate warmer public relations with its own black members and with black American society in general.
Examples of this have been evident in the LDS participation in the national celebration of Black History Month, including focused attention upon the achievements of Black Mormons past and present. And I guess the biographies or the fictional trilogy is being done by Darius Gray what is her name, the woman that's co-authored?
Margaret Young,
yeah, would kind of be in that spirit. On a consistent basis, moreover, LDS multi-stake buildings and other large Mormon facilities have been made available to various religious organizations for commemorating Martin Luther King Day and other Black celebrations. Perhaps most particularly significant was the Mormon outreach to the Black population of L.A. in the wake of the 1992 race riots, which Armin described. Most recently was the invitation extended to LDS President Gordon B. Hinckley to address the Regional One Leadership Conference of the NAACP in April 1998. And in 2001, as Armin also mentioned, the church supervised the processing of the extensive records of the Freedmen Bank. This gesture, as Armin has succinctly stated, that making available and processing the Freedmen records, represents a lengthening Mormon bridge to the American Black community. But on the negative side, the church has been much, much less successful in other areas, specifically in casting off the burden of its own racist heritage. If you will, its own curse of Cain, which Armin took for the title of his paper. This includes almost two centuries of accumulated racial and religious folklore, which just keeps coming forward, for reasons that Armin pointed out. And it's particularly pernicious at the grassroots level. Conversions of Black members in the LDS Church, in the words of Moss, has seemed to wax and wane in the response relationship to local conditions and initiative. He cut this out of the paper, but I think it's worth mentioning that, and one of the things that stuck out to me, there's been an apparently large dropout rate among Black Mormons in the United States generally. He mentioned this in the original draft of his paper. And he also mentioned the reasons for this are varied. These include discomfort over class and cultural differences, feeling of being being treated categorically as Blacks, exaggerated attention as novelties in treatment by white members, continuing undercurrents of racism in certain popular LDS beliefs, this racist folklore, and Black members' resistance, I think this is an interesting one, Black members' resistance to interracial marriage or even dating. Particularly difficult is what Moss characterizes as the general predicament of the individual Black Latter-day Saint. Specifically, and I think this goes into the heart of a lot of what the problem is, how to negotiate an identity that somehow manages the cognitive dissonance between an ethnic or racial definition that he or she can't escape and a demeaning religious tradition that he or she was once encouraged to accept in the process of conversion. As I suggest, this goes to the very heart and soul of the Mormon Black dilemma, as I see it. Indeed, this Mormon dilemma is directly relevant to the experiences of Darren Smith as a Black convert to the church, clearly and forcefully articulated in his presentation today. Smith vividly describes his particular difficulties in dealing with what he characterizes as whiteness in Zion or the invisibility of race. The latter ironic term which he used as the title of a preliminary draft of the paper that he presented here today. Smith is especially concerned about the issue of color blindness or the practice of pretending not to notice or recognize racial differences, which in turn hides and makes it harder to detect race repressive and racist ways. A solution to this problem, according to Smith, is to grant people of color greater opportunities to serve in important and significant positions of church authority. That would in turn have the effect of redirecting and raising the consciousness of white church members. This has yet to take place, notes Smith. Despite the lifting of the priesthood ban back almost 25 years ago, there have been just two Mormons of African descent called to high church positions, namely Habikio Martins in the late 1980s and early 1970s, who served in the second quorum of the 70, which was a general authority, but a temporary general authority position. And just recently, just announced within the last couple of weeks, the appointment to the third quorum of the 70 of Elder Emmanuel Kissi. But that's an area authority, that's not a general authority. The underrepresentation of African Americans in top leadership positions underscores the problems of black leadership in the church, according to Smith. This deficiency, in turn, contributes to the second problem, which he talked about, people both within and outside the church are not attuned to seeing people of color represented or valued or empowered in positions of leadership. Also of primary concern to Darren is what he characterized as a glaring silence in the church, a refusal to engage in race talk. As a result, a myth of progress is perpetuated, which in the words of Smith does not reflect the true reality of coping with a racist society that impacts on the black experience both inside and outside the church. Illustrative of this point, of course, was Darren's poignant description of the ordeal of his wife. In this invisibility, you know, in confronting this invisibility of race, she broached the still controversial issue, and I think it's still very controversial with a lot of people, of interracial marriage. Her Relief Society president was anxious to avoid this because it was considered highly uncomfortable and still controversial. I think, and you know, that goes to what Armin said about so much of our racist folklore that is still inculcated. You pick up statements like Brigham Young stating that any black who mixes his blood with a white, it'll be death on the spot. Or even more recently, in 78, when the black revelation was handed down, it was accompanied, I'm sure maybe some of you remember this, it was accompanied with a statement that the church still strongly discouraged racial intermarriage. I don't know how many of you remember that, but that was kind of issued alongside that. And so, you know, that's still a touchy issue in some quarters. Darren, like Armin, points out the need for reform within the church. He decries, and I like this statement, he decries the one-size-fits-all policy as problematic, not only globally among the ethnic membership of the church, but more specifically for African Americans, noting that the church could learn an important lesson from institutions such as the Black Church. Relevant to this point, and I guess even making this one size fits all is of course the larger issue of correlation, which is ironic and paradoxical. As the church has become more ethnically diverse, there seems to be more emphasis on correlation, and the two are, makes for a very difficult fit. On a positive note, both Smith and Moss see the Genesis Group as a viable institution to help bring about needed reform and change within Mormonism in an effort to make the church more responsive to the special needs and concerns of Mormons of black African descent. Although Moss appears to be more optimistic concerning the role of Genesis in this regard. In conclusion, I found the presentations of Armin Moss and Darren Smith to be both engaging and stimulating, causing me to think anew in new and different ways about the various issues involving the complex and still often difficult situation of African Americans within the church today. Indeed, even though restrictions on Mormon black priesthood ordination were swept away by the 1978 revelation, various aspects of that of this most unfortunate and I feel erroneous legacy lives on, a fact made poignantly clear in the two presentations today. Okay. I guess we go ahead and start with the questions, so you can direct it to either one of our two panelists or even myself. But I'll repeat the question because we're being recorded. Hopefully, did this recording work okay, or did we get this okay? Because I know you're sort of shaking your head. I kind of wondered because we were fiddling with this trying to get it started, and I just wondered if we didn't get the tape.
I think we missed a couple minutes, Darren, but when I turned it over, that thought...
It had stopped. It had just stopped, and a hand got turned over, so we got most of it. Okay. Okay, the question over there, back there.
Yeah, I'm wondering, and this is a question for all of you. I'm
wondering, well, maybe you could come forward and ask your question. Why don't you come... Yeah.
Is the Book of Mormon problematic for our views on race and for people of color? And I'm aware that we've changed a few words around, but it seems to me that the book still equates a darker skin with some form of person.
Yeah, the question is the Book of Mormon problematic in dealing with the issues of race, of trying to get beyond this racial folklore? From my perspective, I would say yes. In many ways, Darren and I, we've talked a little bit about this, and I discussed it extensively in the opening chapter of my Saints, Slaves, and Blacks. But I'll let Darren and Armin go ahead and answer that. Would you care? I don't think I can move this cursed thing. It looks like it's taped. Let me see. I just a little bit of force. That's what my wife always says. Use a little bit of force. Hopefully. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, I guess I just wanted to comment on that. One of my areas of interest, research, focuses on whiteness theory. Whiteness theory argues that there's typically four specific areas that address racial issues. One of these issues would be the discursive notions of whiteness, discursively meaning the discourse of whiteness and so on, and how the language is used in a specific way that evokes a kind of consciousness, color consciousness, that creates binaries, dualisms, oppositions of knowledge or reality. What's interesting about that is if we have the courage to go deeper into trying to understand ourselves, trying to then change the institution, then everything is subject to scrutiny. Even the Book of Mormon. There's a colleague in my program actually. I don't know how she's going to get away with this, but she's actually doing her thesis on racist language in the Book of Mormon. Now, she teaches in the seminary program. I don't know how she's going to do that, but she's figured out a way to do it, and she's addressing that. So I'm excited to see her work come forward.
Armin,
so,
you have a comment?
I think whether or not the Book of Mormon is problematic in this respect depends on how you interpret it. It's not entirely clear what Joseph Smith thought about this by the time he died. He is responsible, personally, Joseph Smith is, for the change from white and delightsome to pure and delightsome. And comparable changes would have been made in that same edition if he had lived long enough to make them, I think. So what he thought was involved for the Lamanites here as a color category is not at all clear. See, a lot of saints forget and their critics too, that by the time the story of the Book of Mormon ends, there are no ethnic differences between Lamanites and Nephites. They go through a 200-year period of total merger of the two peoples. So that by the time the Book of Mormon ends, the Lamanite-Nephite difference is not an ethnic category. It's a category, it's an ideological category. The Nephite, term Nephite refers to people who are supporters of the church. Lamanites refers to the people who aren't. In the meantime, all of them have been descended from all of Lehi's children. So there's plenty of room there to work with this problem within the context of the Book of Mormon without having to make a big to-do about the Book of Mormon as a racist document. If you keep doing that, we aren't going to get anywhere. What we got to do is see what we can do within the text of the Book of Mormon itself to bring about new ways of understanding what the language of the Book of Mormon says. A discourse that looks racist in one generation does not have to be interpreted racially in other generations. I think that's what we have to work on.
There's a flat-footed declaration by God in 2 Nephi that he is no respecter of persons, male or female, black or white. You can't get it any more flat out by 26 to 33.
Okay, another question.
Now we're sort of opening this up to include the Lamanites and a whole world of people of color, for that matter. I wonder how most of us react, including the panel, to the ethnic units the church is creating. Now, the Genesis group, I know much less about, but I wonder if the Genesis group perpetuates segregation the way I know some of these other units do. We have over 100 units just right around where we sit today. Cambodians, Chinese, lots and lots of Spanish-speaking Latinos, all of whom are put in their own little place, their own ward, their own branch. My son just told me they're going to create a Filipino branch in the area where he lives in San Diego. I wonder whether this doesn't perpetuate this separation and not operate in favor of or liberal accepting church.
I wish you could have come forward and put your question into the microphone. I think if we maybe people could come forward. We've got a small enough room, so if you could queue up if you've got a question and ask it directly in the microphone. I'll try to do half justice to your question. But your question was, to sum it up as succinctly as possible, the fact that all of these various ethnic congregations and ethnic groups are being formed as the church has become more ethnically diverse, is that perpetuating perhaps kind of a racist stereotypes or feelings of us versus them rather than a feeling of we? Does that get the spirit of your question? Let me go ahead and let both of our panelists respond to that.
Well, first of all, let's remember that the Genesis group is not an ecclesiastical unit of the church in the way that a ward is. Genesis group is a monthly meeting where black people from all of the different wards of the Salt Lake Valley come together for a meeting once a month. So the rest of the Sundays, I mean, they're presumably in their own respective wards. So that's a kind of a different issue from what we're dealing with here. And also, Genesis has come to be as much a support group for mixed race families as it has come to be for black people in particular. So that's different. Now, on the issue of ethnic branches, there is no consistent church policy on this. It keeps changing. And one of the complications is, are you talking about language or are you talking about ethnicity? You might be able to defend a temporary organization of a church unit based on language differences. That's different. And if you can justify it on that, that's one basis. That may or may not mean perpetuation on an ethnic or racial basis. Or even a cultural basis. So, every time you get a new president of the church, you get a reversal of the previous policy on ethnic branches. That's the way. That's what the history's been.
The church tends to be local-centric. If you go to Utah, where many of my relatives are, you can walk around the block for two blocks and catch the whole ward and all the administrative people in that ward. If you're energetic and you want to walk 15 minutes, you can catch the entire high council and all the state presidency and all the other wards in that state. So in that environment, it perpetuates certain types of thinking when you only deal with your neighbors all the time. Now, we in Southern California, for example, in our state, as one of the progressive Palos Verde state, and we have, in one case, absolute segregation between the Anglo and Hispanic populations, physically removed, but built on the local-centric premise. Their location is here, my group is here, and we never deal with each other unless you're called to do so. Okay. Now, in the main high-income area, where we have mixed ethnicity, mainly between Asian subsections and Anglo subsections, we share the same buildings, but we have different apparent groups, but the children get commingled underneath. You see what I mean? So the point is, different adjustments are made to that local-centric model. But if everybody is just dealing with people who are within 5 blocks or 10 blocks of each other, it's hard to get personal.
To try to sum up your comment as best I can. Kind of another Mormon dilemma, the fact that on the issue of race and diversity is that each ward tends to be, self-contained, pretty much interacting with people within that ward and those self-contained wards. Palos Verde, you said your particular ward is, or your stake is...
Well, we have some wards that are part Japanese, part Asian.
Yeah.
And then there's a part Chinese, part Anglo. But the children get commingled in the same class.
Yeah,
the parents have separate...
Yeah, the parents tend to be segregated in terms of who they're with in their wards, but the children, there's more intermixture. And I guess the point that you're trying to make on that is that maybe more interaction like with the children, is that suggesting that as a possible?
Yeah,
the next generation might have a more enlightened looking, hopefully toward the next generation, they'll be more flexible and more enlightened and more willing to jettison things like the racist folklore and that. Would you care to
one quick comment?
Go ahead, come on forward.
We have brought in for Anglo congregation we have a Chinese bishop, and his family has interracial marriages, which is kind of interesting over just the last so many years, single-digit years.
I have found that simply importing people of color into predominantly hegemonist wards is not necessarily going to alleviate any racist thinking. I think that's a project that people have to be willing to unpack. They have to be willing to deconstruct their own reality, how they perceive race. We're talking about what sociologists call modern racism, which is much more subtle and much more covert than it has been in former times. So this is a racism of ideologies, right? How we think, how we construct. And so just a brief summation that we have talked about this Book of Mormon thing. It's not so much the Book of Mormon is a racist text, but it's what black represents in the social consciousness of folks' mind, right? What that evokes, right? So that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about, like I said, Klan and skinhead. We're talking about social constructions of knowledge, where we get knowledge.
I'm afraid we're going to have to cut this off. We've alas run out of time. If you want to come forward and talk to various panels, it's 1:45. Is that what you have? I guess we unfortunately have to. yeah, we have to cut it off. I wish we'd go on for another half hour, another hour. But thanks for coming.